This episode of Lines of Inquiry is supported by Shopify. There's a moment at the beginning of any new venture where the scale of what you're trying to build becomes clear. An idea might start small, a product, a brand, even a podcast like Lines of Inquiry. But very quickly, the list grows. Design, payments, marketing, orders, customer questions. Running a business means wearing a lot of hats, and often it can feel like you're doing it alone. That's where today's sponsor comes in. Shopify is the commerce platform behind millions of businesses around the world, from household names to brands just getting started. It allows you to build a professional online store with hundreds of ready-to-use templates designed to match your brand style. Shopify also includes powerful AI tools that help write product descriptions, generate page headlines, and even enhance product photography. When it comes to finding customers, Shopify makes that easier too, with built-in tools for email campaigns and social media marketing. And behind it all is world-class expertise in everything from managing stock to international shipping and processing returns. If you're ready to sell, you're ready for Shopify. Support from Shopify helps us to create new episodes of this podcast every week. We couldn't do it without their support. Please support the businesses that support us. Sign up for your €1 per month trial and start selling today at shopify.ie. It's time to see what you can accomplish with Shopify by your side. Two Gardaí drive into the car park of a large pub on the crossroads of the N11 in Wicklow. It's just after 4:30 in the morning of the 19th of March 1996. A call has come through to their station in Arklow, County Wicklow, reporting a panic alarm going off at the pub. The car park appears normal as they pull up out front. A door is open. It leads into the private living quarters to the side of the main entrance. Garda Martin McAndrew can see a light on in the hallway. He looks in and sees a woman slumped on the floor. She is wearing only a nightshirt and underwear. She has material hanging around her neck. Her hands are tied. He came into the bedroom. He had a knife. He had a knife and a hood over his head, she tells the guard. His colleague, Garda Paul Comiskey, looks closer at the ties around her hands. The first is a soft belt from a dressing gown. It can be easily removed. But underneath are two headbands wound tight around her hands. The woman is in shock. She winces in pain as they lift her off the ground. They notice jewellery scattered on the stairs and a jewellery box discarded in the room they carry her into. "Where's Tom?" she asks. They know Tom, her husband, and they know her. The guards look upstairs and find no one else. They begin searching the rest of the pub. They find Tom in the kitchen. He is lying on his back in a pool of blood. He has a wound to his chest. Tom is cold to the touch. More Gardaí arrive. Jack White's pub is now a crime scene. Superintendent Pat Flynn arrives and sees the woman sitting on the couch, the woman who has just lost her husband. She is Catherine Nevin. He sympathises with her, but she doesn't say anything to him. His colleagues say Catherine is in distress. Pat isn't so sure. He looks around, taking in the scene. A robbery gone wrong, maybe? Or perhaps something else. He suspects there is something more to learn. When someone is murdered in Ireland, the Gardaí call in a team of forensic scenes of crime examiners from the Technical Bureau. For 25 years, I was a part of that team. My name is John Sweetman. I was there to help read the silent and often hidden clues at a crime scene. I saw what killers tried to hide. Fingerprints unknowingly left behind. Murder weapons hidden in plain sight. Handwriting that betrayed a lie. Every detail told the real story. And now, I'll tell you those stories. In this podcast from Go Loud, I take you inside some of Ireland's most haunting crimes. This is Lines of Inquiry, a Go Loud original podcast that looks beyond the headlines, following the evidence step by step and uncovering the stories behind the investigations. In this episode, the murder of Tom Nevin, and a story of greed, lies and lust that led to one of the country's most infamous trials. The 18th of March, 1996, was a busy day's trade at Jack White's Inn near Brittas Bay, County Wicklow. It was a bank holiday Monday, and customers made the most of the remaining hours of the long St. Patrick's Day weekend. There was cause for celebration for the owners of the pub too. Tom and Catherine Nevin had bought the place in 1986, on that very same weekend, 10 years previously. There was a main lounge with another area called the Middle Bar. Food was served too, with a restaurant upstairs. Located at a crossroads on the N11 between the towns of Wicklow and Arklow and beside Brittas Bay in Ballina Park, Jack White's was a popular spot. Nearby was Jack's Hole, a mobile home and caravan park populated by families during the summer months. The name of the pub is based on a story of a local smuggler back in the 1700s who would bring in contraband goods by sea through Jack's Hole. Tom and Catherine lived over the pub, but in separate bedrooms. Staff thought the couple's relationship was more of a business partnership than an intimate one. They would get on with their chores and tasks, and those around them heard them speak of little beyond work. Tom was liked among his employees. The 55-year-old was a tall man at 6'3", but rather than look imposing, he was considered something of a gentle giant. He was kind to his staff. Usually young women working in temporary roles as cleaners or manning the bar. Some of the younger girls even called him Daddy, an affectionate term for his gentle nature. He looked out for them. Catherine, who was 10 years younger than her husband, was a stricter boss. And she had a temper. Once, she threw a knife at a staff member because a plate warmer wasn't working properly. She didn't want food served to customers on cold plates. "I am a bitch and proud of it," Catherine once proclaimed to Fiona Lawler, one of her part-time waitresses. Before beginning work that day, Catherine took a B12 injection. She suffered from pernicious anemia, an autoimmune condition that prevents the body from absorbing the vitamin. She wasn't feeling well overall that day. She had her period and she was tired. It had been a very long working weekend. She took a tablet to prevent swelling of her hands and legs before starting work around 12:30 in the afternoon. She had an hour and a half of work under her belt when Tom began his working day at 2:00. Tom mingled with his customers throughout the day. He played some darts and even caught a bit of a Tom Cruise movie on the television over the bar in the lounge. Catherine moved between the two bars, serving customers that included a group of horse trainers and racing fans, a pub owner from nearby Roundwood, and a family with a small child who she didn't recognise. Just before 11:00 that night, Sergeant Richard Dominic McElligott from Avoca Garda Station popped in for a pint. Dominic was what everyone called him. It wasn't unusual for Gardaí stationed in Avoca and other surrounding stations to pop in. When the couple took over the pub in 1986, it was even known as a Garda House, where members of the force stationed in Arklow would gather after they clocked off duty. But over the years, relations had soured when Catherine made a sexual assault allegation against one of the Garda members. She claimed he had been driving Tom's 15-year-old niece home from the pub one evening when the alleged incident happened. A second Garda had been in the car before the alleged assault occurred. Catherine's complaint didn't go down well. Two members were suspended, and the pub found itself in the bad books with Arklow Station, as Garda members withdrew their custom. The ordeal had rattled Catherine. Although she had other Garda friends, she never trusted the Arklow branch again. Some staff thought Catherine looked on edge that bank holiday Monday. Bernie Fleming, who worked in the bar, noticed her boss moving quite a lot from the pub to the Nevins' private living space upstairs. Catherine mentioned she was moving about to keep an eye on a load of clothing she had in the washing machine. But Catherine never used the machine. Catherine didn't know how to work it. Bernie clocked details that were unusual that evening, like the curtains that were always open were now closed. When another staff member, Liz Hudson, used the washing machine around 11:30 that night, she found the inside drum of the machine was bone dry. It hadn't been used that evening at all. Cleaning and washing were jobs for Catherine's staff. Almost all of the customers were gone just before midnight. Shortly afterwards, staff left. There was a disco in the Tunnel nightclub in Arklow, and taxis and a bus had been called to ferry them to the dance. Usually, they would be allowed to stay over in the guest rooms of Jack White's, but Catherine had told them they couldn't. "There is nobody, and I mean nobody, staying here tonight," she said. Tom Nevin drove two customers home, just as the bus to Arklow pulled out of the car park at 10:10. Tom did this a lot, seeing locals home safely before returning to the pub. This meant he wouldn't take a drink until after the pub had closed. Having driven the two customers home, Tom returned to the pub around 10 minutes later and found Catherine in the middle bar. He asked if the drink trays had been emptied and cleaned. He went over to the cash register and put in his ZL key, a master key that registered the total on the tills and the time of those transactions. The receipt roll time read 12:56. Tom left to do the accounts at the kitchen table. Before he did, he told Catherine he'd be off to Dublin the next day to check on some flats that they owned. But Catherine wasn't paying attention. She was tired and needed her bed. She told him she would let Dominic out of the pub first. Tom was usually the one who locked up the windows and doors. That was his nightly routine. Catherine let Dominic out the front door, but didn't mortise the lock. Tom would do that. She took a drink she had poured for herself, a scotch and white, with her to bed. She took a sleeping tablet and quickly fell asleep. Tom was still downstairs. By March 1996, Tom and Catherine Nevin had been married for 20 years. They met when Catherine worked as a receptionist in the Castle Hotel on Gardiner Row just off O'Connell Street. The hotel was close to Sinn Féin's headquarters on Parnell Street, and senior Republicans would often drink in the hotel bar. Tom was working as a bar manager in Freehill's pub in Dolphin's Barn, his uncle's place, and he would drop into the hotel bar for drinks in between his shifts or when he had finished up for the day. A friendship formed long before any romance, because Tom was already married, although that relationship had broken down. Tom was born in September 1941, and he had grown up in Nutgrove, Tina, in Loughrea, County Galway. His parents, Patrick and Nora, were farmers, and Tom was the eldest in a family of 9 children. When he was 18, he moved to Dublin and began working as a barman. It was there that he met June Flanagan, a County Mayo woman who was also living and working in Dublin. They married in 1962, and moved to England for a few years, where Tom worked in bars in London before returning home to Ireland and setting up their home in Dublin. The marriage broke down after 8 years, when June had a child with another man. She blamed herself. She said Tom was a gentleman, a kind gentleman, with good morals and the humble ambition of owning his own pub and his own home. He loved hurling and GAA, and she never saw him drunk. While the annulment was applied for in 1970, It took until 1975 before it was heard in the High Court, and another year for the court to refuse it. Tom appealed to the Supreme Court, and in 1984 he eventually won. The marriage was annulled, and Tom was free to marry again. Catherine Nevin was born Catherine Scully and lived in the small village of Nurney in County Kildare. Her father, Patrick, was a small farmer, and her mother Mary was a seamstress. Catherine had two siblings, Betty and Vincent. Catherine was hard-working at school and good at sewing and dressmaking, skills she'd picked up from her mother. After she left school, she bought some sewing machines and travelled around Ireland for a time teaching other women about dressmaking, before settling into her job at the Dublin Hotel, where she would eventually meet Tom. Catherine loved beauty and style. She did some night courses in beauty, with a view to opening her own modelling agency one day. One of these was in the art of deportment, the art of manners and behaviour in a social setting. Keeping up appearances was very important to her. Catherine Scully and Tom Nevin began dating in 1974, 4 years after he and June had split up. 2 years later, in 1976, Catherine and Tom married in a small ceremony at St. Patrick's Church in Rome. But they did so knowing Tom's first marriage hadn't yet been annulled. Divorce wasn't allowed in Ireland then, and all the couple could do was wait for the outcome of his Supreme Court appeal to make their union legal. On their wedding day in Rome, they looked like a wealthy young couple. Catherine wore an expensive lace dress with embroidered flowers in her veil, forming a delicate halo around her face. Tom wore a fitted navy suit with a grey waistcoat and tie. When Tom eventually won his civil annulment, he and Catherine married again in a low-key and less glamorous ceremony. It was in the registry office at Molesworth Street in Dublin. But this time, the marriage was recognised in the eyes of the law. On the 11th of April, 1984, Catherine and Tom Nevin were legally married. Soon after the first wedding in Rome, with Catherine's encouragement, Tom started to invest in the property market. He bought a number of flats on the South Circular Road in Dublin. The couple lived in the one-bedroom flat and rented out the other rooms. It was there the couple began to build their property portfolio. Tom managed the accounts while Catherine searched for potential investments. Tom's dream was to own his own pub, and that dream grew closer when Catherine secured a lease on Barry House in Finglas. The pub had a reputation as a troubled spot. It was often closed because of antisocial behaviour. But Catherine could see its potential. It was set in the heart of a close-knit community. There was a gap in the market for a local pub. The Nevins could make it work, but it was in an area where outsiders were frowned upon. And to make it work, Catherine and Tom would need local support, people established in the area who could endorse or vouch for them as the new pub's patrons. John Jones had a television rental and repair business in Finglas in 1985. When Catherine Nevin came to him for advice. She was hoping to buy a pub in the area and had been told that the Sinn Féin's advice centre might be able to help. Jones's business operated above the centre and he was chairman of the local Sinn Féin Cumann. He told her he couldn't help, but Catherine and Tom Nevin did lean on local Republicans when they secured the leasehold. Some were hired as occasional bouncers at the door. They knew the community best. They could keep the peace. The Republican newspaper, Unfublocht, was sold there, and customers included Sinn Féin members. Fundraisers for the party were sometimes held there. In Niamh O'Reilly's book, The Black Widow, The Catherine Nevin Story, she wrote how there could be no confusion around the protection offered to Catherine and Tom while they went about running their pub. One day, a man with paramilitary links led his donkey into the bar with him, ordering them both pints. Tom obliged. The pub couldn't run without the help of Republicans. Catherine and Tom Nevin now had the experience of running their own pub, but it wasn't enough for them. They wanted to buy their own place and in a wealthier part of the country. Catherine described Barry House as a pub in the middle of a housing scheme, very much a working class area. Catherine wanted a place in a more affluent area, with wealthier clientele. In March 1986, Tom and Catherine Nevin bought Jack White's Inn at Ballina Park, County Wicklow, for £270,000. Tom had fulfilled his one big dream. He finally owned his own pub. And Catherine had her wish of owning something a little more upmarket. Catherine came into her own as the boss of a wealthier establishment. Her appearance had always been important, but now she installed a hair salon at the pub, so her hair was always styled and her clothes were fashionable. Her looks were important too. She had three surgeries at St. Vincent's Hospital in 1990 and 1991. Liposuction, a tummy tuck, and surgery on her eyelids. She was vain, and she was confident. "Julia Roberts isn't pretty enough to play me," she allegedly once said. On that St. Patrick's weekend in 1996, several hours after Catherine Nevin went to bed with her scotch and white, an alert rang at Bell Communications. James Curry was the operator on duty, and he saw it was an alert from one of their panic alarms. It came in at 28 minutes past 4 on the morning of the 19th of March. It was from a pub in County Wicklow, and he immediately notified Gardaí in Arklow. Gardaí, Paul Comiskey and Martin McAndrew were the first Garda members on the scene. They drove around the car park first to see if there were any strange cars, then pulled up to the front of the pub. Garda McAndrew walked towards the front door leading into the Nevins' private living quarters. It was open slightly, and a light was on in the hall. Inside, he found Catherine slumped on the floor. Material was hanging around her neck, and her hands were tied behind her back. He came into the bedroom. He had a knife. He had a knife and a hood over his head, Catherine told him. Garda Comiskey bent down to assess the ties around Catherine's hands. The first was a belt from a soft blue dressing gown that was easily untied. Underneath it were two headbands in Wicklow and Wexford County colours. They were tied so tight a knife was needed to cut them off. They left red marks around Catherine's wrists. Catherine seemed to be in a daze. She spoke low and softly. She was wearing only a purple silk nightshirt and white underwear. The two guards tried to lift Catherine off the ground, and she winced as if in pain. The Gardaí sat Catherine down on a couch in her sitting room. Garda McAndrew explained to his colleague that the material around Catherine's neck was a nylon stocking stuffed with black underwear and used as a gag. She had managed to push it out of her mouth. Catherine was in shock. Her eyes were rolling in her head, and she was cold. Garda Comiskey went upstairs to her room and took her quilt off her bed to wrap around her. "Where's Tom?" she finally asked him. "Dominic is gone. Dominic was here," she added, and Garda Comiskey realised she was referring to Sergeant Richard Dominic McElligott, the last customer in the pub. Even with the quilt around her, Catherine shivered, so the Garda took off his jacket and put it around her shoulders. Looking around the room, he saw a jewellery box lying on the floor of the lounge. Its contents spilled onto the floor. There was jewellery on the stairs too, and drawers had been pulled out of their cabinets. Catherine asked for Tom again. "Where is he?" Every time she asked, she tried to get up from the couch only to fall back down again. She was deeply distressed. The two Gardaí went to look for her husband. They moved up the stairs beside the lounge, avoiding the jewellery strewn across its steps. On the landing, they found an upturned portable television and noticed the bedroom light was on. This was Catherine's room. It was large and untidy. A wardrobe was open, with all its contents spilling out onto the floor. Beside the bed was a copy of the Sunday Independent, large quantities of medication, and a half-full glass of what looked like wine. A jewellery box was open, and its contents scattered around the room. The side cabinet had its drawers removed, pulled out and discarded on the floor. The Gardaí then made their way back downstairs and into the kitchen. And that's when they saw Tom. He was lying on his back on the floor. He had a wound in his chest. Tom had been shot. A pool of blood had formed around him. Garda Comiskey looked for a pulse. There was none. Tom's skin was cold. The guard then called a local doctor, and at 5 o'clock on the morning of the 19th of March, 1996, Tom Nevin was pronounced dead. In the early hours of the morning, shortly after they arrived at the scene, Catherine Nevin told Gardaí of a terrifying ordeal. She said she woke to a man standing over her. He had shouted at her, "Where's the fucking jewellery?" And he had said he'd kill her. He wore a mask and was shouting at her as he pushed her into her pillows. Catherine told the Gardaí that she was terrified. The room had been dark, but a light on in the corridor outside allowed her to see a flicker of a blade. The man had a knife in his left hand, and she could hear movement elsewhere in the room. There was someone else there. She said she had felt her arms being pulled behind her back. One of the men was tying material around her hands. Some other cloth was shoved into her mouth. She was gagged and bound with her hands tied behind her back, just as the Gardaí had found her minutes earlier. She heard another sound from downstairs. A sound like a saucepan hitting the floor. She heard two cars driving away. And then, silence. Catherine didn't know how long the raiders had been there. She tried to call for help from her mobile phone on a locker beside her bed. She couldn't do it. Her hands were still tied behind her back. And as she tried to dial the numbers 999, she just couldn't do it. The telephone slipped from her hands and fell onto the floor. With the ties loosened around her feet, Catherine made her way downstairs and tried to open the front door. It was impossible, but there was another option. She reached the panic alarm and pressed the button. That was shortly before 4:30 a.m. And then, 10 minutes later, the two Gardaí had arrived to free her. Superintendent Pat Flynn was fast asleep when the phone by his bed started ringing. It was 4:45 in the morning. He wasn't on call that weekend at Gordie Garda Station in Wexford, but Pat knew a call at that time meant something urgent, business that couldn't be ignored. It was Tony Ryan, a Garda colleague from the Arklow Station in Wicklow. "Superintendent Flynn, you had better get up to Jack White's straight away," Garda Ryan told him. "Tom Nevin has been shot, and Catherine was tied up." "Is he dead?" Pat asked. "Yes," came the reply. Pat Flynn knew Catherine Nevin. He drank and dined at Jack White's in the past. And he knew she had ruffled Garda feathers with allegations over the years. The time she reported an incident against Tom's 15-year-old niece, and the time, some 4 years earlier, when she had made written complaints against a Garda member in his Wexford branch. Pat referred to these as false allegations. In July 1992, he was summoned by Chief Superintendent Pat Crummy. Catherine Nevin had made complaints that were of a criminal nature. serious claims that had to be investigated. In one complaint, Catherine detailed how she'd been assaulted by a Garda in her pub. She claimed that she had been working past midnight in August of that year, when a Garda came up behind her as she was getting him a whiskey. She claimed he had pinned her to an ice maker, pulled up her skirt, and tried to force himself on her. The Garda she had named always denied these charges, and an investigation and a ruling by the DPP saw no criminal proceedings brought against them. When Pat Flynn saw Catherine Nevin that March morning, he sympathised and asked if he could be of any help, but she made no reply. He didn't expect the two to hold a conversation because of her previous allegations against his colleagues, but he was expecting a woman whose husband had just been shot to be more emotional. He didn't share the same opinions as his two other colleagues that Catherine was in distress. Flynn felt something off about how Catherine behaved. He thought it was surreal, and she wasn't showing emotion or grief. He didn't think it was shock. Catherine didn't want to give a written statement to Gardaí. She told Detective Joe Collins, who had arrived to take a statement, "I will make no statement or sign anything." She told Collins that she didn't trust his colleague, Superintendent Pat Flynn. "I want a guarantee from a superior officer and not the superintendent, I don't trust him, that my statement wouldn't end up on a desk in Arklow to be doctored," she added. Superintendent Flynn looked over the rooms in Jack White's, now a crime scene. He walked through the lounge where Catherine sat, the kitchen where Tom's body lay, and the bedroom. And when he was sure there'd been no interference in any of the rooms, he prepared to leave. As he did, another senior Garda arrived, Inspector Tom Kennedy, who was stationed in Wicklow. "Terrible affair, Pat," Tom Kennedy said to him. "Just heard it on the news. That poor woman. What have they done to her? Such a decent, honourable woman." As Gardaí tried to piece together what had happened, it started to look more like a botched robbery. Tom Nevin was still working on the pub's accounts for the weekend when he was disturbed by the armed men. His books lay open on the kitchen table beside an unfinished glass of Guinness. He was shot and knocked off the high stool he'd been sitting on. That piece of furniture now lay broken beside him. Tom's glasses were still on his head, and a biro was still in his hand. It must have all happened quickly. He was crept up on and shot, killed where he sat. Gardaí discovered that Tom's car, a black Opel Omega, was missing from the car park. Catherine Nevin had heard two cars that night, and now Tom's appeared to have been taken during the robbery. As this information was shared on national radio stations, members of the public called Gardaí with sightings of their own. Mary Power of Ballyduff in Ashford, County Wicklow, was twice alerted by her dogs to a black saloon car reversing into her drive that morning. The car arrived after 3 a.m. and again at 4:10 a.m. Kenneth Cole from Greystones was at a junction in Cabinteely in Dublin at around 3:40 in the morning when he saw a car fitting the description with a 92D registration plate. He saw a young man around 30 years old in the car. He had bushy, wiry, reddish, blondish hair. The car was eventually located in Dartmouth Square in Ranelagh in Dublin, unlocked, with the keys still in the ignition. Residents in County Wicklow were horrified as reports of a shooting and robbery in Jack White's dominated the news headlines. For many, this was yet another example of local businesses being targeted by predatory Dublin criminals, including a group who called themselves the M50 Gang, after the newly finished motorway that allowed them to quickly access country businesses before making quick getaways back to Dublin. There had been a spate of robberies in the area. It seemed Jack White's was simply the latest in a long line to be targeted. On the same day Tom Nevin had been shot, the European Golf Club, just 3 kilometres from Jack White's, had its telephone wires cut. The golf course had been robbed 4 times that year. Locals in Ballina Park mourned Tom's death. Jack White's was a home from home, they said. It was the venue of choice for community christening and retirement parties. They knew Tom as a quiet man, and not a man deserving of that kind of end. Tom Nevin's post-mortem was at 4:30 on the afternoon of the 19th of March. It was performed by the then state pathologist Dr. John Harbison. From cuts on his chin and bruises on his shins, Dr. Harbison believed that Tom Nevin had been conscious for about 30 seconds after he was shot. Tom died within 4 minutes of the bullet wound. The cartridge from the gun fired had discharged a total of 9 pellets. A single entry wound on the right side of Tom's chest, with 4 exit wounds around his left shoulder joint. The pathologist determined that not only had Tom Nevin been shot at point-blank range, but that the type of ammunition used was typically used for big game. As the kitchen of Jack White's had kept the body warm, Dr. Harbison couldn't say the exact time of Tom's death. Catherine Nevin didn't leave the pub, despite friends and relatives of Tom encouraging her to do so. Despite her initial unwillingness to give a written statement, she finally did so on the 20th of March, on the advice of her solicitor. It was Detective Garda Joe Collins and Detective Sergeant Fergus O'Brien from Wicklow who arrived to speak with her. In the days after the murder, Detective Garda Willie Brennan took swabs from Catherine's face and hands for any firearms residue and examined Tom's body, where he found propellant powder tattooing or gunpowder burn marks on his clothing around the gunshot wound. Marks like this come from close-range shooting, Detective Brennan deduced. The shot that killed Tom would have been discharged within 1 to 4 yards. Tom had been taken by surprise. He didn't have an opportunity to defend himself. Gardy discovered that the Nevins had their own shotgun on site at Jack White's. Catherine said she was the gun's license holder, which was usually kept in the rafters of the storeroom. She said Tom had thought it too dangerous and brought it downstairs. Both she and Tom had cartridges for the gun. As well as recounting the night of the robbery when she was tied up and gagged, Catherine told them how Tom had been followed a couple of weeks before the shooting at the pub. She had told this to Inspector Tom Donnelly, and he had reported it back to his colleagues. Catherine told Gardaí that Tom was driving back from the Cash and Carry when he noticed a car keeping pace with him, speeding up or slowing down when he did the same. He had even told a customer about it when he returned to the pub, and how he had been worried because the boot was full of pub provisions. The incident had shaken him. Meanwhile, in the days after the murder, the team from the Garda Technical Bureau examined Jack White's for forensic evidence. Fingerprints were taken from the discarded jewellery box in the lounge, and Catherine's room was searched for any further evidence. In Catherine's bedroom, Gardaí found a remote control transmitter for a panic alarm in the drawer of a small table close to the bed. A further search showed a mobile panic alarm, the same as the one she had used downstairs, behind a closed curtain on a windowsill behind the bed's headboard. Both were working. They also found a box of 25 shotgun cartridges for a 12-gauge shotgun, the kind used for clay pigeon shooting. But these belonged to Tom Nevin's own licensed single-barrel shotgun, found in a storeroom off the kitchen. Tom Nevin was buried in Barndarrig Cemetery that week. Catherine cut a lonely figure dressed in black with a single red rose in her hand. Catherine's parents and sister Betty stood by her side. Tom Nevin's surviving siblings stood with her at the graveside, where she told them what had happened again. She had been reading a newspaper when raiders burst into her room. She was frightened. She feared she would be killed. This story was different to the one she had told Gardaí, where she had been sleeping when she woke to a pillow pressing into her face. Catherine went back to running the pub. In the background, Gardaí worked from an incident room at Arklow Garda Station, tracing phone calls to and from the pub. They examined the pub's bank accounts for any clues as to why Jack White's was targeted, beyond being a lucrative business. Hundreds of witnesses, including staff, friends of Catherine and Tom, and local businesses, sat for statements as Gardaí tried to piece it all together. They even recreated a shotgun shooting to determine whether it could be heard from Catherine's bedroom. She had told Gardaí she heard something that sounded like a saucepan hitting off a floor, but she said she hadn't heard a gunshot. On the day of Tom Nevin's funeral, Detective Garda Fergus O'Brien and Detective Garda Joe Collins had visited the pub. Catherine was working. She led the two Gardaí into her sitting room and left the room for a moment. In the centre of the living room there was a table, and on that table was an open newspaper. Detective Garda O'Brien picked up the paper and noticed an address book underneath. It was open. Joe Collins knew what it was. He had seen Catherine Nevin use it before. They could see what was written on the open pages before them. Detective Garda O'Brien recognised the name. It was the name of a man who had been convicted of armed robbery and had former connections with the IRA. His name was Jerry Heaps. One month later, Jack White's was officially searched. Among items seized as evidence were two scraps of paper found on Catherine's bedside locker. One had a phone number written on it, but no name. The other was a UK license plate number, DIL5206. 2 days later, Detective Garda Fergus O'Brien was shown the same address book. Flicking through it once more, he noticed the name Jerry Heaps had been scribbled over. It hadn't been like that before. He had made a note of what he had discovered. They would need to investigate all avenues, and Jerry Heaps was one of them. Catherine Nevin contacted Gardaí out of the blue at the end of May. She said she had information on the case and had hired her own private investigator. Detective Garda O'Brien felt that Catherine was showing signs of stress. Her eyes were blinking and jumping a lot, similar, according to the detective, to the morning of her husband's murder. Gardaí continued interviewing the staff of Jack White's. As they did, a startling picture emerged around Catherine and Tom Nevin's marriage. Some staff believed Catherine had been unfaithful to Tom. There had been affairs, they claimed. One of these was with a local Garda inspector, Tom Kennedy, the colleague who had expressed sympathy for Catherine to Superintendent Pat Flynn on the morning of the murder. One former staff member, Carolyn Strahan, said that she was not sure if Tom Nevin was aware of this. She had seen the man in Catherine's bed on one occasion. He wasn't wearing a shirt. Tenants of a house owned by Catherine and Tom Nevin in Rialto had seen Catherine with a male friend when she stayed over some weekends. And there were allegations of a second affair, this time with a judge. Former cleaner, Jane Murphy, told Gardaí that Dunica O'Buchala stayed over at Jack White's. Two other staff members, Elizabeth Hudson and Bernie Fleming, claimed Catherine had given him keys to the premises. Both Tom Kennedy and Dunica O'Buchala denied any sexual involvement with Catherine. But it seemed Tom Nevin knew about Catherine's affairs. In 1993, he had been admitted as a patient to St. John of God's in Stillorgan in Dublin, a hospital for people with mental health issues. There he told a fellow patient that his wife was cheating on him. "Anyone could have her but himself," Tom had confided. The former patient described Catherine as cold when she came to visit Tom. He said she would be there for Tom to complete the pub's books, not to inquire after his health or well-being. When a retirement party was held for Tom Kennedy and Jack White's, Tom Nevin told a staff member that this will all end in tears. Catherine began sharing more information with Gardaí about her relationship with her husband. She painted a picture of a man with a drinking problem, one that could sometimes culminate in violent outbursts. In one conversation with the then Assistant Commissioner Tom McHugh, she said that her husband drank around a litre of whiskey each day. He was also a heavy smoker who went through 60 cigarettes in one day. He was an alcoholic, she told him, and he could be violent when he was drunk. On one occasion, she had been hospitalised. A former barman told Gardaí Tom would regularly drink after work, usually half a bottle of whiskey. Gardaí was slowly building a picture of an unhappy marriage in the years leading up to March 1996. A step-aunt of Tom's told investigators that he had cried to her about Catherine's affairs back in December of 1994. She said Tom told her he was afraid of Catherine. He said he couldn't leave her because she would not settle for half the business in a divorce. She wanted it all. Tom said he did not want to put his elderly mother, Nora, through the strain of a second divorce. A week before Tom Nevin's murder, Dunica Long was fitting carpets in the pub when, during a conversation with Catherine about her husband, she called him a queer and she was going to have him done. It seemed to Gardaí that by the time of the shooting in March, both Catherine and Tom Nevin were resigned to a loveless marriage. She had mentioned to staff that the pub might even be sold, or that she would buy out Tom's share. In what witnesses would call a flaming row between the two just weeks before the shooting, Tom shouted at Catherine in front of the staff. He told her to fuck off wherever she wanted, before adding he would not sell out to her. Another Jack White staff member, a former waitress, Una Doug, claims Catherine once told her, there are two ways Tom Nevin would kill himself. It would be either in a car with drink taken or during the course of a break-in, because he would have drink in him. On the day of the break-in, a mother of a young woman working in Jack White's phoned Catherine to say her daughter was ill and couldn't come into work. This mother told Gardaí that during the phone call, Catherine said that she was going to fucking sort Tom Nevin out. Tom Nevin was dead the following morning. By the 27th of July 1996, over 4 months after Tom Nevin's death, Gardaí had enough evidence to arrest Catherine. They brought her to Enniscorthy Garda Station for questioning. Catherine Nevin wouldn't answer a single question. She refused all offers of food. Gardaí read all the notes back to her, asked whether they were correct, and asked whether she would sign the document. She remained silent and wouldn't sign. And after 48 hours, she was released without charge. On the same day as Catherine's arrest, Gardaí also arrested Jerry Heaps. They arrested him under Section 30 of the Offences Against the State Act, which allows Gardaí to detain suspects connected to serious organised or paramilitary crimes. Heaps wouldn't cooperate with Gardaí. Like Catherine, he was held for 48 hours and was also released without charge. Gardaí appeared to be at a dead end until they were contacted the following day. It was Jerry Heaps. He would talk. Jerry Heaps told Gardaí he first met Catherine Nevin at the Sinn Féin office in Finglas in 1985. This was when the Nevins still had the lease on the nearby Barry House. Jerry Heaps met Catherine frequently and said he knew Tom personally, and both he and his wife were invited to the opening of Jack White's when the Nevins took it over. Roughly 4 years later, Catherine asked him to go on a drive with her. At Dublin's Phoenix Park, she told him she was having trouble with Tom Nevin. She said that he was making her life hell. Heaps told Gardaí that Catherine had said that Tom was beating her up and having affairs. Catherine claimed that Jack White's had been bought with her money, and Tom gave her none. Heaps said he found it hard to believe, as he always saw Catherine with plenty of gold jewellery and money. He knew she often went on holiday. Finally, Catherine got to the point. She asked Jerry Heaps if he would get rid of her husband. Heaps said he didn't think she was serious. Catherine suggested doing it on a bank holiday weekend, when Tom would be carrying between £20,000 and £25,000 in cash. Heaps told her £25,000 isn't worth a person's life. Jerry Heaps told Gardee about several meetings he had had with Catherine between 1989 and 1990, where Catherine suggested staging a robbery. He claimed she even once said Patrick's Day weekend would be the ideal time to do it. He said Catherine suggested he shoot Tom Nevin when the couple were out for lunch in the Grasshopper pub in Dublin, close to the bank where Tom deposited the weekly earnings. When Heaps told Catherine the risk of her being shot in this scenario, she said all the better if she was wounded, because then she would really look the part of the grieving widow. Jerry Heaps said he refused Catherine Nevin every time she raised the issue. Then he mentioned a name that Gardee had already linked evidence to. The owner of the car, the registration number of which had been found on a scrap of paper at Jack White's. His name was William Willie McLean. Heap said he had met Willie McLean at the opening party for Jack White's after Tom and Catherine Nevin bought it. McLean was having an affair with Catherine at the time, he claimed. William McLean was born in Monaghan, but lived in Harold's Cross in Dublin. He had previous convictions for fraud. When Gardee paid McLean a visit and asked him if he knew Catherine Nevin, he told them that they had met at the Red Cow Inn on the Nace Road in Dublin in 1984 or 1985. They had an affair for around 2 years. He said the affair ended when Catherine became, as he put it, too possessive. Willie McLean worked at Jack White's some weekends. Catherine paid him in kindness, he told Gardee. Tom Nevin knew about their affair. One morning, Tom walked into the bedroom while McLean and Catherine were in bed together. Tom just asked his wife for keys to one of the Dublin flats and closed the door behind him. In 1990, long after his affair with Catherine had ended, Willie McLean said he and his girlfriend called into Jack White's pub for a drink after being out for a drive. McLean said this was the only time that his car was parked outside Jack White's. Catherine asked him if he had a telephone number. He told her if she wanted to get in touch with him, to call him at his local pub, the Irish House Pub, Harold's Cross. 6 to 8 months later, a call came into the pub. It was Catherine. She was ringing from St. Vincent's Hospital. She was apparently in for treatment on an issue with her heart. Willie McLean called over the next day. Catherine told him that she still loved him. But Willie was not interested in starting the affair again. Then he claimed Catherine said, "There is £20,000 there to get rid of Tom. You and I can get back together." She went on, saying, "Get him going to the bank or at the flats." McLean said no and left the hospital. Gardee now had two statements from two men claiming that Catherine attempted to have Tom Nevin murdered, and the timelines added up. In September 1996, Gardee discovered that Tom Nevin had taken out a life assurance policy worth £70,000. On December 4, 1996, Detective Sergeant Fergus O'Brien and Detective Garda Joe Collins returned once more to Jack White's Inn. They told Catherine Nevin that two men had made statements claiming that she had solicited them to murder Tom. Catherine told them to contact her solicitor. But there was one more piece of evidence to follow up on. The scrap of paper with the phone number. It led Gardee to Dublin Airport to a man driving shuttle buses. His name was John Jones, the man Catherine sought advice from when she was trying to get a lease on Barry House. John Jones was not surprised to see Gardee. He said that when he saw that Tom Nevin was murdered, his initial reaction was, God, she's gone ahead and done it. Jones claimed he had plans to go to the guards himself with what information he had, but he was advised against it, as it could raise suspicions about his role. Because of his associations with Sinn Féin and his Republican views, Jones said he was sick of the treatment he had received from the special branch over the years. He told Gardaí he was sure Catherine had been behind Tom's murder. He said it was blatantly clear to him. According to Jones, Catherine Nevin walked into the Sinn Féin office in 1989 or 1990 and told him she wanted to arrange for the IRA to shoot her husband. He claims she propositioned him 6 or 7 times over a year and a half. On one occasion, she called into the advice centre wearing black glasses with bandages on her wrists, claiming Tom had hit her. But each time Catherine propositioned him, Jones said he refused. Gardaí had their case. On the 14th of April 1997, over a year and a half after Tom's murder, Catherine Nevin was arrested and charged with the murder of her husband. She was also charged with 3 separate counts of soliciting Heaps, McLean and Jones to murder him between 1989 and 1990. Catherine Nevin wanted to kill her husband, and she would pay someone to do this for her. Catherine's reply to all charges was, "I am not guilty." Even before her trial began in January 2000, Catherine Nevin had captured the imagination of Ireland's press. They named her the Black Widow, and the language of the tabloid newspapers scrutinized her appearance, demeanor, and sensationalized her life with Tom. Catherine Nevin was described as beak-nosed and as a sex pest who had contacted 3 contract killers to take Tom out. She was a woman obsessed with her image, money, and power. Whenever she arrived at the court, Catherine was immediately subjected to a media frenzy. Everything was written and talked about, from her makeup to her nail varnish, her freshly dyed blonde hair, and to the clinging dresses she wore. The defense immediately accused the press of legal bias, and Justice Mella Carroll ordered that, until this trial is finalized, there should be no further comment on Mrs. Nevin's dress, hairstyle, nail varnish, or reading material. No further photographs are to be published of her until the trial is over. She said Catherine had a right to wear whatever she wanted without being dissected. The case was heard in the Central Criminal Court and was called the People versus Catherine Nevin. Senior counsel for the prosecution, Peter Charlton, used a metaphor to help explain to the jury that although all the evidence against Catherine was circumstantial, it would be sufficient to prove her guilt. If you have a very large tree which is diseased in your back garden, and you have to get rid of it because it is a hazard to you and your children, and you get someone in to take down the tree, then in law you are responsible for it, he said. This was the same as if you asked someone to kill on your behalf, he said. The responsibility lies at your door. But the prosecution did concede that while they aimed to prove Catherine had Tom murdered by someone else, they did not know who that person was. Paddy McEntee, Catherine's senior counsel defence lawyer, entered a plea of not guilty on all counts. The trial did not get off to a good start. On the 26th of January, less than 2 weeks after convening, the jury was discharged. A courtroom usher reported he could hear the jury's deliberations through the fire escape door of the courthouse. Justice Carroll had no choice but to dismiss the jury and replace it with a new one. A second trial collapsed in February when a pregnant member of the new jury fell ill, while the third and final trial was briefly interrupted when Catherine Nevin was too unwell to attend. John Jones testified on the 28th of February, Jerry Heaps on the 1st of March, and William McLean on the 2nd of March. All 3 men reiterated and expanded on testimonies and statements previously given to Gardaí over the previous 4 years. All three claimed Catherine Nevin asked them to murder Tom Nevin between the years 1989 and 1990. All three mentioned money offers of between £20,000 to £25,000. All three testimonies claimed that the murder was to take place as a robbery gone wrong. And all three had refused Catherine Nevin's requests. Detective Sergeant Fergus O'Brien gave testimony about finding the address book in Jack White's with Jerry Heap's name written down and later scribbled out. The defense argued that Jerry Heaps had simply called Jack White's to rent a room and that, after an argument with Catherine, the name was scribbled out. Paddy McEntee said there were inconsistencies in Jerry Heaps, William McLean and John Jones' narratives and that each of the three men had a personal motive against Catherine Nevin. McEntee claimed that Catherine was a widow who had been targeted by unreliable witnesses. And the defense reiterated a crucial fact that pervaded the entire trial. There remained no physical evidence linking Catherine to the murder of Tom Nevin. On the 14th of March, Catherine Nevin finally took the stand. She remained in the witness box for 6 days and 20 hours of testimony. The prosecution called more than 170 witnesses over the course of the trial. Catherine was one of only two witnesses called by the defense. If she were innocent, she had to prove it herself. On the stand, Catherine spoke of her marriage, with her voice sometimes dropping to little more than a whisper, with tears in her eyes. Contrary to testimony from the three men and staff from Jack White's, Catherine said she and Tom had a good marriage, but it was sometimes marred by Tom's drinking. She referred to him as a disciplined alcoholic who mixed spirits into Guinness. Catherine then told the jury a piece of information that shocked the entire courtroom. She said that Tom Nevin was secretly a member of the IRA. When asked why Catherine had never mentioned this before, she said she had made a solemn promise to Tom never to reveal this truth. She said at the opening of Jack White's, guests included senior IRA figures such as Joe Cahill and Cahill Golding. Catherine denied ever wanting Tom Nevin killed. She said, I never at any stage of our married life wanted Tom out of my life, ever. Tom was a big, big part of my married life, and he always will be. Catherine was asked if her marriage with Tom was sexually active. She replied, yes. She was asked if she had affairs with other men. She answered, no. Tom and I did not have a troubled marriage. There was nothing wrong in our marriage, she told the court. There had been efforts to target the couple, she claimed. Tom had been followed by a car and was rattled by his experience. She had been staying in their South Dublin house when a man in an anorak had broken in and forced her to drink a milk-like substance. He had poisoned her, she claimed. But no evidence was found to substantiate her claims. Garda Inspector Tom Kennedy and Judge Donacha O'Buchla took to the stands to deny claims from staff members that they had sexual relations with Catherine Nevin. Both men had always denied the allegations. Later, the trial called the people who knew Tom Nevin best. By the time of the trial, Tom's mother, Nora, had passed away, but his four brothers and three sisters testified on behalf of their sibling. The family dismissed all of Catherine's claims about Tom. They denied that he was ever in the IRA, that he had any Republican sympathies, or that he had ever expressed such views to any of them. Tom's youngest sister, Margaret Lavelle, testified that from 1976 to 1979, Tom and Catherine shared a one-bedroom flat on Mayfield Road off South Circular Road. This contradicted Catherine's claim that she and Tom had never shared a bedroom. The Garda Special Branch, who monitored IRA activities, had no file on Tom Nevin. June Flanagan, Tom Nevin's first wife, rejected Catherine's portrait of Tom as a violent drunk. She claimed to have never seen Tom drunk. It had been suggested previously that Tom Nevin had only checked into St. John of God's under duress from Catherine, and that his alcoholism had been exaggerated. In April 2000, after weeks of testimonies, the trial ended. The 61-day criminal trial was the longest murder trial in the history of the state up until that time. It was 5 days before the jury reached a verdict. As she entered court to hear the verdict, Catherine Nevin had £200 in her handbag that she had planned to splash out on a round of celebratory drinks for her family. Catherine Nevin was sure she would be found not guilty. On the 11th of April 2000, Catherine Nevin was found guilty of murdering her husband Tom by a unanimous verdict. On the charge of soliciting John Jones in or about 1989 to murder her husband, she was found guilty by a majority verdict of 11-1. On the charge of soliciting Jerry Heaps to murder Tom Nevin in 1990, the jury returned a unanimous verdict of guilty. On the charge of soliciting William McLean in 1990, Catherine was found guilty by an 11-1 majority. Her sentence was the mandatory one for murder. Life. In her closing statement, Justice Mella Carroll spoke to Catherine Nevin. "You had your husband assassinated not once, but twice. Once in life, and in death by assassinating his character." Catherine remained calm and composed as the verdict was handed down. She sat upright with her hands resting on her lap, eyes staring straight ahead. She took off her wedding ring and handed it to her sister Betty before she was taken to the Dulcis Centre at Mountjoy Prison. Catherine Nevin spent 17 years in jail, but she always maintained she was innocent. Jerry Heaps, John Jones, and William McLean took a libel action against members of the press who had described them as hitmen and would-be killers. Catherine Nevin tried to appeal her sentence 3 times. She also remained active in legal proceedings regarding Tom's estate, which she still hoped to inherit one day. Tom had died without making a will. His death meant Catherine Nevin was a wealthy woman. But Tom Nevin's family, his siblings, would never allow that to happen. Tom's brother Patrick and sister Margaret brought an application to the High Court to disinherit Catherine. The Court of Appeal ruled that a conviction of her husband's murder could be used to stop Catherine from inheriting any of Tom's property. Tom's family argued that a murderer should not benefit from the victim's assets. But the Supreme Court never reached a verdict on the matter of inheritance. Because in 2016, Catherine Nevin was diagnosed with a brain tumour. In early September 2017, she was released from prison on compassionate grounds due to her illness. She died in hospice care. Catherine Nevin never said who pulled the trigger on the shotgun that killed Tom Nevin. She never admitted her part. She never said sorry. Catherine brought the name of Tom's secret assassin with her to the grave. Thank you for listening to this episode of Lines of Inquiry. We now have an email address, linesofinquiry@goloudnow.com, and we would love to hear from you, so get in touch. Whether you have a story you think we should cover, or just want to let us know how you felt about an episode, that email is linesofinquiry@goloudnow.com. If you're listening on Spotify, please leave a comment on this episode and let us know what you think of the podcast. We really appreciate those who have taken the time to give the podcast a review. With well over 4,000 five-star ratings on Spotify already, I am genuinely humbled by the support. Thank you. That generous support helps us to tell these stories. If you haven't yet rated the podcast, I would be grateful if you could give us a 5-star rating wherever you're listening, sharing it on your story on Instagram, or simply telling a friend that you're listening to the podcast. Make sure to like or follow the podcast in your podcast app, and hit the notifications button so you'll know every time a new episode is released. Lines of Inquiry is presented by me, John Sweetman. The podcast is created by Darren Cleary. Our executive producer is Owen Brennan. Our producers are Siobhan Maguire and Siobhan Walsh. Sound editing and design by Neil Kavanagh, with additional editing support from Ed Smith. Social media, marketing, video, and legal support comes from the Go Loud team. This episode was written by Kevin C. Olahan and Siobhan Maguire, with script editing from Siobhan Maguire. In the end, everything done in the dark comes to light.